Welcome to Space Strategy, a podcast from the American Foreign Policy Council's Space Policy Initiative, where we are shaping a vision for the next strategic frontier. Now here's your host, AFPC Senior Fellow in Defense Studies, Peter Gerritsen.
Welcome to the Space Strategy podcast. I'm your host, Peter Gerritsen. Today, my guest is Lieutenant General John Shaw. Lieutenant General John E. Shaw is the Deputy Commander, U.S. Space Command. U.S. Space Command is the United Combatant Command responsible for conducting operations in, from, and to space to deter conflict and, if necessary, defeat aggression, deliver space combat power for the joint and combined force, and defend U.S. vital interests with allies and partners. Lieutenant General Shaw entered the Air Force in 1990 as a distinguished graduate of the United States Air Force Academy with a degree in astronautical engineering and a minor in Russian language. He has served in a variety of air and space operations and staff positions, including operations tours in the 50th Space Wing, the National Reconnaissance Office, the 32nd Air Operations Group, and the Space Warfare Center. His operational commands have included the 4th Space Operations Squadron, the 50th Operations Group, and the 21st Space Wing. He also served as U.S. Strategic Command as Director of the Commander's Action Group and as Deputy Director for Operations in the Pentagon as an Air Force intern, as Deputy Chief of Space Strategy and Integration, as a speechwriter, and as Senior Space Policy Advisor. Prior to his position, Lieutenant General Shaw was dual-headed as the Commander, Combined Forces Space Component Command, U.S. Space Command, and Deputy Commander, Space Operations Command, U.S. Space Force at Vandenberg Air Force Base, California. He also served as the Deputy of Air Force Space Command, United States Space Force. Welcome, General Shaw. So you are the Deputy Commander of U.S. Space Command, but looking at your uniform there, you are also a U.S. Space Force officer. So can you explain to us what both of those are and what is the difference?
Hey, you bet, Pete. Hey, thanks for having me today, by the way. And thanks for your leadership in doing this podcast and getting us thinking about the future and about space and strategy. So I'm just happy to be with you here today. Hey, so I like to tell folks it's kind of exciting to be a member of two startups, right? Space Force and Space Command, neither of which, they're both under 3 years old right now as you and I are doing this podcast. And they are kind of new and unique organizations. We don't have a setup in the Department of Defense where we have a branch of the services as well as a combatant command that are responsible for the same domain and the only ones really essentially responsible centrally for that domain. And so it's been interesting to see it from both angles and see how do we organize and how do we set up a new branch of the United States Armed Forces to be responsible for the space domain, the organizing, training, equipping of capabilities and people and culture for space. And then at the same time, as we're set up, and most of your listeners know the way we're set up as a Department of Defense, that we actually execute warfighting operations via combatant commands, right? The service chiefs don't really do that. They deliver the capability. Of course, the members of those services are integral to our joint organizations and are those warfighters, but they are command and control and warfighting operations conducted by combatant commands, and we're the new United States Space Command. So I find it interesting, and we're continually working together, Space Command and Space Force and the other services and the other combatant commands, to kind of refine and shape what the roles and responsibilities of both of those organizations need to be within the broader Department of Defense.
Well, thank you for that. And so how do you describe your own role in the space ecosystem and sort of what opportunities and problems command your attention?
So maybe a little bit of background. It'd be good to talk about what is a combatant command, right, in the United States military. You know, we really started with this construct back in the mid-1980s with something called the Goldwater-Nichols Act that established these joint commands and joint meaning multi-service. And there used to be just two flavors of them. And U.S. Space Command is breaking the mold here. The two flavors we used to have is we had geographic combatant commands, and many of your listeners are familiar with those, Central Command, CENTCOM, or European Command, which is getting in the news an awful lot these days because of what's happening in Ukraine. But we also had other combatant commands called what we traditionally called functional combatant commands. Think Transportation Command or Special Operations Command. They weren't assigned a geographic area to be responsible for, but they were responsible for providing trans-regional capabilities to the other geographic combatant. Well, U.S. Space Command, at least the one that we stood up coming up on 3 years ago now, it broke the mold. We're actually both. We continue the tradition of the old U.S. Space Command and space functions as they were within U.S. Strategic Command before we stood up, of the classical functional combatant command, of making sure that we're delivering trans-regional capabilities to all the other combatant commands. But the newer part is we are also given an AOR, an area of responsibility within the President's Unified Command Plan. And that makes us not a geographic combatant command, because that doesn't make sense linguistically. We're an astrographic combatant command responsible for an area 100 kilometers above the surface of the Earth and extending outward indefinitely. The answer to your question, Pete, is that's kind of how our focus is. We're continuing to be as good as we possibly can be to deliver space capabilities to the warfighters in the terrestrial spheres. And that is probably, I would say, our primary focus day to day in our operation. Are they getting all the SATCOM they need? Are they getting all the surveillance reconnaissance they need? Are they getting precision navigation timing? All the things that space capabilities bring. But we are also responsible for our area of responsibility and protecting and defending within that domain. That's a relatively newer mega mission set for us that we're working on as well. When you put those two together, that's what's on our plate. And that's kind of where I would start to, at least starting to answer your question, how do we continue to do both of those equally well and stay ahead of our pacing adversaries?
Now, you talk about these two new startups, but you're certainly no newcomer to this. You've been an advocate of space power for as long as I can remember. In fact, when you were a major in 2002, you authored a book, Wither Space Power, which is still considered one of the seminal works on space power theory and used in our professional military education. 20 years in, how do you think that's held up?
So you're very kind to call that seminal. I hope it's useful to people. And I did co-author that with mutual acquaintance, Brigadier General, retired Pete Warden, who has gone on to do even more wonderful things in the space arena in different sectors. In fact, I just traded texts with him a couple days ago. He's doing great. By the way, for your audience, you can download a free PDF of this if you go to Air University and search for Wither Space Power. I think the things that have, and again, I'll try to be as objective as I can. There were a lot of things we didn't get quite right. You know, we actually didn't talk about a separate service in that book. We did talk about the evolution of the Air Force into an aerospace force. We knew that that had to happen, but we really weren't really so bold as to suggest a different service. So didn't get that quite right. But maybe some of the enduring principles I think that are still working today is the future scenario that we envisioned, the large one in the book. It did anticipate China would be our pacing adversary back in 2002. And we kind of saw that coming even back then, and it seems to have been borne out. And so those that read and see how the fictional war plays out, that I think starts in the book, I think it starts right around now and extends out into to the middle of the century. I think that one was sort of, we saw that coming, and that's maybe helpful to look at. Some other principles maybe in the work that I think we are still seeing today and realizing are the need for, as we do national security activities in space, they are going to be supporting more than just wars in the terrestrial spheres. They'll be supporting protecting capabilities in space, and they'll be supporting other endeavors in space, whether they be commercial or scientific or exploration focused. And that's just the way we've always operated as a Department of Defense since the founding of the Republic. And we saw it no differently in the space domain. And I think I think those same conversations are taking place today. You're on many of your podcasts, you talk about these very same things. And so I guess that might be, I think, what's sort of held up well, is those principles of what a national security space will have to do and who the pacing adversary would be.
You know, your book anticipated in many ways exactly what we're seeing. I noticed in the recent U.S. Space Command Senate testimony, the discussion about getting prepared to support the NASA Artemis for space and security. And I noticed that the Artemis Accords were cited in a recent paper as well. And I think Wither Space Power really does a good job of anticipating sort of this broader movement into broader global utilities, into eventual utilization of cislunar and the moon and asteroids. And of course, your book also anticipates that we might, on top of GPS, come up with another global utility for power. And of course, Air Force Research Laboratory is currently working on the SPIDER program to try to make power beaming a reality.
Hey, I do think that power from space is a technology we need to develop as a nation and as a planet. It's there for the taking. You know, the numbers escape me right now, how much solar energy actually hits the Earth that we don't use. It's tremendous. And that's not to mention what's out there that could be captured. It doesn't even hit the planet. And so we'll be doing that. And I'm glad AFRL's continue to look at it. It's not the number one priority here at U.S. Space Command right now. We got so many other things on our plate, but it's no doubt something we need to pursue as a planet.
So you haven't stopped your career of writing. And in fact, you've got a brand new piece out. And in fact, I think you've sort of continued the same relationship of having more than one author, a senior author with some additional help, just as you wrote with General Warden. So tell me a little bit about this new piece, Sailing the Wine Dark Seas, and what are some of the big ideas in that?
Yeah, we had so when I say we, I had some colleagues here, Gene Ferguson and Amy Swallow here at U.S. Space Command with me, that we had been working on this piece for a while. It was based on a talk I gave at Space Symposium last year being 2021, and had the opportunity to get it published in the new Ether publication at Air University. The premise of it, I sort of alluded to already, Pete, the fundamental premise of it is that the U.S. Space Command being assigned this new area of responsibility that I described, right, 100 kilometers above mean sea level and outward indefinitely, it could be seen as sort of a small afterthought, but it's actually central to how we define ourselves at U.S. Space Command and in many ways beyond Space Command and the Department of Defense, the responsibilities and the implicit tasks that means. And it's a nod to Homer and to some other historical works that I've read, the title of the book, but points to the fact that this is the first in military history we've had areas of responsibility, right? We can go back to ancient times, but this is the first one in military history where an area of responsibility was not geographic, it was astrographic. And so there are a few points that I make, and one of the points that I draw out is actually one that's sort of a reality check for us. As we focus on this new AOR and what our missions might entail and the implied tasks within the space area of responsibility, the first thing I point out is that, hey, we should remember that it's really all about what's happening in the piece that's not an AOR. It's about what's happening on our planet, where everybody lives, where warfighters need our capabilities. And that's sort of the beginning part of the article.
So, you know, as a futurist, though, that gets me wondering, because, of course, you allude in the article to the fact that the Romans had, you know, several AORs in Spain. But, of course, their most important AOR would have been directly surrounding Rome. And then over time, you know, the center of gravity moved elsewhere as that empire grew. One of the things that I think is interesting about both the posture statement and this article is that it seems to take seriously the intent of the civil and commercial sector to actually expand outward.
Yeah, again, you know, I believe it's inevitable that we will be expanding. It's just, and there will be commercial ventures traveling further and further into space, right? It'll be more than just space tourism. It'll be search for resources. It'll be other mechanisms to further economic interests here on the planet and beyond once that infrastructure develops. It's inevitable. It's really a matter of how fast it'll happen, what business cases close in the near term that make people want to invest in such things. And against that backdrop, I do think that the U.S. government and therefore the Department of Defense has a responsibility to encourage such investment along those lines. How would we do that? One way is we get transparency of what's happening in the domain. You know, it shouldn't be this translucent or even opaque medium that people aren't sure if they go there or will they be under threat or how will someone be watching for their security and how do we keep it sustainable as well. And I do think that U.S. Space Command has a role and will in the future and will Space Force.
Now, I noticed that the Space Command seems to have pretty nuanced talking points on this. And so I was wondering, do you think the responsibilities of a combatant command are different across the spectrum of conflict? Are the roles distinct in peacetime and competition as compared to actual war and war fighting?
Well, I mean, I think to read it sort of back to you, Pete, I do think there are roles across the continuum of conflict. Some will be the same and change, and some others may start or stop. But, you know, to best answer a question wouldn't necessarily be talk about space. I would just point to other domains. The maritime domain, I think, is one that tends to fit well, tends to be one I write the most about, although all the domains and all of the services that operate in those military services and that operate in those domains offer us insight into how we should be doing things in the space domain. But the United States Navy doesn't sit in port waiting for a war to start. They're out there patrolling, projecting power, sending messages, ensuring security and stability on the high seas against a variety of peacetime or crisis threats and being ready. And the Coast Guard helps them. I mean, and so You know, it has to be, I believe it'll be the same thing in the space domain. We'll be operating capabilities for transparency and safety and security and assurance within the domain to send messages and show any actors that might be thinking otherwise that we're there to protect and defend our nation's and our allies' capabilities. But when there's a transition to conflict, and the number one goal is to avoid that in the first place, in fact, one of the reasons to be there is to deter such a conflict from happening in the first place. But if deterrence fails, we need to be ready to take actions to protect and defend our capabilities, and we will. And again, that's exactly what the United States Navy is doing across the combatant commands that it has components within, and the Coast Guard to some extent. So I hope that helps answer your question. I really think we can look to that as a model for how we'll be doing things in space in the years to come.
Now, I want to just pull on that thread a little bit, because it's not necessarily obvious to many thinkers why naval analogies, why a Navy or Coast Guard are relevant examples. Many people sort of start with a little higher, a little faster air power, very vertically oriented looking down. So why do you personally find the maritime analogy to be more helpful?
So, wow, this could be a whole podcast in itself. Pete, maybe we'll do a part two sometime. And I know you've got a lot of listeners that probably have some strong feelings about this. Let me say that I do think that every tradition of the military in different domains has something we can learn from. For example, I do think that the development of air power has a lot to offer in terms of looking at things strategically that transcend geographical boundaries, that can apply projection of power over long distances and in ways that could achieve political purposes aside from the mere immediate battlefield. I think there are pieces of that we could really pull on that say, I think space power will do that same kind of thing in the future, but projecting over even more immense distances than Billy Mitchell could have ever imagined. The reason I think the maritime domain tends to be one that works better is there's two factors. The first is, it is the openness of that domain. We call the seas the global commons. I don't like calling space a global commons because it's not global. It's super global, but it's a super global commons that lots of different actors can be traversing at any particular time. And I think that's a commonality we have to really understand, that you can't own parts of the space domain. It's going to be a commons of some kind. How do you then project power, protect and defend in that environment? The second feature we actually already hit on, and that's the idea that, you know, I said the Navy doesn't sit in dock waiting for a war. It's out there. The Air Force and the Army, a little less so. They tend to maybe probably stay in garrison until it's time to go, right? I think the idea that the Navy's always out there, it's doing peacetime missions, it's projecting and showing power, it's supporting other interests of the nation and our allies, is another thing that has commonality with the space domain as well.
So you mentioned in your answer the second desertion of your article. So you talked that essentially that global is insufficient and that we need, and you coined this new term. So let's talk a little bit about super global and why we need to invent a word.
Yeah, that part of my article is mostly just meant to be a troublemaker in many ways. Our Department of Defense is struggling right now. Not struggling, we're working hard. We got some really good thinking going on right now with how do we do globally integrated operations. It's a realization that, you know, our department realizes that you can't look at warfare from strictly the theater that's going to operate in or strictly one or two domains. It's going to be multi-domain and it's going to be transcendent of region. And so we tend to talk in terms of global. You'll see that in a lot of the vernacular and doctrinal thinking right now. And in many ways, it's a good thing. It's trying to think bigger. When I say I try to be a troublemaker, I'm actually pointing out global's not big enough. If you think global, that tends to bring to mind the planet. And when you think about our AOR, the importance of space capabilities that are outside the globe, and how that AOR, the relevant battle space of our AOR is expanding all the time. I think it's extending to the lunar sphere as of right now. Then global is not sufficient. And so we kind of came up with the idea of supra global to say, hey, it's a globe and the relevant spaces beyond it that encompass the entire relevant strategic space that the Department of Defense and the nation needs to be thinking about.
So you mentioned extending all the way to the lunar surface, and of course, cislunar is a word that I spend a great deal of my time thinking and writing about, but that's a pretty strong assertion. Why would you say that you know, this, and I forget the exact word, I want to make sure I got the right word, whether you said battle space or AOR, strategic interests, you said something was extending to the lunar surface. And I know some people would be very uncomfortable, anybody military saying anything about that, or they would deny that there is, in fact, any reason for us to be concerned about what are called civil missions, you know, out onto the lunar surface. So tell me a little bit about your thinking about Cislunar and why this deserves any attention at all.
Sure. Hey, first a clarification. So just for definitional purposes, our area of responsibility is 100 kilometers above the mean sea level and outward indefinitely, period. I mean, that's a huge AOR. That is the entire universe minus the planet, a little bit atmosphere. Just so we're clear, that's the definition. I use the term relevant battle space or relevant strategic space to constrain that a bit. But U.S. Space Command is not concerned about security activities around Alpha Centauri yet, and maybe not even the outer planets or even Mars right now. But right now, I do think that you cannot look at a gravity well depiction of the Earth-Moon system and not see that there are strategic points between the Earth and the Moon beyond geosynchronous orbit that are clearly potential, and this is where I can use some Army terminology, right? Some clear high ground terrain that we need to be interested in, because potential adversaries may be interested in that. It may be interesting for exploration and or commercial purposes as well, in which case I think we have as an implicit task, since it's in our AOR, to understand what's going on out there to protect American interests and allied interests as they progress. So it isn't the moon itself. It's realizing that the Earth-Moon gravity well system is one that is going to be occupying our thinking, our strategic thinking in the years to come, and it's not too early to be thinking about that. I also have to say there's some practicalities. You know, NASA, with the Artemis missions that they're putting together, are planning to get back to the moon here in the next few years. They need to understand what's happening in the lunar environment for space domain awareness, for protection of the astronauts. And I'm not talking about human threats. I'm talking about natural threats. The same way that today U.S. Space Command is providing conjunction alerts, collision avoidance alerts to the International Space Station for possible debris that may be on a collision course, there are those same sorts of things that could happen in the lunar environment too. How are we going to do that? NASA, when we talk with NASA, we think we need to do that together. And so again, we can keep peeling this back, but there are interests clearly within the Earth-Moon system that we need to be thinking about as we go forward.
Within that context, you sort of led into your third point in the article, which is that we have to reimagine key terrain. And you redefine this and you sort of add two new terms to how to describe key terrain and location in space in the article.
So I think you're referring to upwell and downwell, I think, are some. The reason we came up with those terms, we're getting kind of nerdy here, but that's okay with a space podcast, right? You know, the physics of the space domain is just not necessarily intuitive, and it's different from the other domains. And it's just, first of all, that's a starting point to realize. And one of the examples I like to give is that it may not seem intuitive, but it actually takes just as much energy to go from a circular geosynchronous orbit down to a circular MEO orbit as it is to go from that circular MEO orbit up to the circular geo orbit. Intuitively, we think getting further away from the Earth, going up the gravity well, is the hard part, and come back down is somehow easy. Doesn't work that way in space. Those energy differentials are exactly the same no matter which way you go. And so our team was trying to introduce this idea that it isn't really going uphill or downhill or up or down. It's realizing you're going up a gravity well and down a gravity well, and the energy costs might be similar regardless of what you're doing. That's very tactical. And what that gets at is a broader point of, we really need to think about how we operate in the space domain within gravity wells, which are the primary terrain feature in space, are gravity wells. How do we operate within those? What are the constraints? What are the advantages? What are the capabilities we need to be able to maneuver in and out of, within and outside of them, as efficiently and as effectively as we possibly can? Ideas such as speed and distance, which we think about perhaps in the other domains we can see in the terrestrial domains, don't mean as much in the space domain as things like energy and angular momentum if you're within a gravity well.
So that sort of brings to the final point of the article, which is that you assert that the definition, the creation of space as an AOR, is basically relevant to everyone.
It was kind of a so what. You know, I wrote an article and it's relevant to everybody. First, I'll just start with, you know, U.S. Space Command, we're proud to be a joint command. And so even though the lion's share of our capability that we get from the services is coming from the U.S. Space Force, we also get capability from the other services, and we need to. And the other services need to be interested in space. It's hard for us to imagine an alternative history where in the early 20th century, the Navy and the Army, aside from the Army Air Corps, didn't care about air. Like, that's the Air Corps' business. We don't care. It clearly and very quickly, practically, became everyone's business. The Navy cared about it. The Army cared about it broader than just the Army Air Corps. We eventually had a separate service, and the Army and the Navy and the Marines continued to care about it. In fact, every service has air capability. I think that same philosophy applies across the services. Space matters to all of them, and they need to think about it and put it into their doctrine. And by the way, to the credit of the services, I think they realize that. For an example, the Navy and the Marines recently, within the last year, have moved toward creating their own space cadre. They each called by different names in those services to have space experts in those services. The Army has done that for a long time and very well. That's just the Department of Defense. I can bring that more broadly that, there will be geopolitical and astropolitical dynamics that play out in the space domain in the years to come. And therefore, the United States government has to be cognizant of that, and it becomes their business too to understand what's going on in the space domain. And I could go on and on, but the idea is that it isn't just going to be Space Force and U.S. Space Command. It's actually everyone's interest to understand what's going on.
Speaking of that, one of the things that I was personally very pleased to see was that in General Dickinson's testimony, how much commercial featured is being important. And in fact, it was very interesting for me to read in the testimony that the Unified Command Plan essentially provides U.S. Space Command with a defensive commerce mission.
So one thing that is, here's an interesting feature about commercial space activities, that almost every commercial space activity has some sort of national security utility to it. And that's relatively rare to see in the other domains. And so if you agree with that theorem, which I believe is true, then naturally we should be developing relationships with commercial industry across the board to make sure we are leveraging those capabilities as best we can for national security purposes. Go on just a little bit of a side road here, Pete, that again, as we're having this podcast right now in May of 2022, the conflict in Ukraine is still ongoing. It's been interesting to see just in the couple months that have progressed so far, the role of commercial space is already playing, at least in the information environment, if not in the actual military environment. And two examples I would bring up would be commercial imagery, which has been something that not only Ukraine has had access to, but also the entire world is able to see in near real time what's happening in Ukraine, whether it's convoys moving towards Kyiv or away from Kyiv, or even atrocities being committed. That's being seen, and that is commercial space imagery that's doing that, part of the information environment. More recently, SpaceX's Starlink terminals that are going into Ukraine are providing yet another layer of information connectivity to the rest of the world. And I don't think we'll ever be the same again. I think we're seeing a new form of connection that is going to be a challenge for any kind of authority that tries to prohibit the flow of free information. We're seeing that unfold as well. I could go on about other commercial. We in U.S. Space Command are very interested in space domain awareness commercial capabilities and harnessing those where we can to get as much data as we can to be able to use that to better understand what's happening in the space domain.
Now, this was the statement that I found so profound. General Dickinson says, "The UCP assigns me the responsibility to protect and defend U.S. and as directed allied partner and critical commercial space operational capabilities." That's pretty broad.
The best way to answer that is an analogy to the maritime domain. I don't think anyone in the U.S. Navy would ever say it is not our responsibility to look out for commercial shipping. That is part of the American or allies' economic interests. Of course it is. We see counter-piracy operations today happening along those exact same lines. And so I think what General Dickinson is saying there is we're not going to, if there is a national interest at stake that involves our commercial space capabilities, we're probably part of the solution.
Now, both his testimony and your article each have some forward-looking things to say about astronaut rescue. So I think both articles mention the fact that you currently have a responsibility to aid in the assistance of astronauts. And then both articles seem to hint that as this expands, it's going to become quite a significantly increased level of effort if we see the kind of expansion that we're thinking is going to happen.
Yeah, let me break that into two pieces. The first is, what are we doing today that we're explicitly supporting? And that is, DOD has, since the very beginning of human spaceflight has had a role in supporting that human spaceflight. We go back to the early 60s, there was definitely Department of Defense involvement, helping to recover astronauts and being prepared if something were to go wrong, to be able to assist with a more drastic, I guess, recovery operation. That's actually our job today. So when the commercial crew capsule, when Dragon takes a commercial crew to the ISS or is returning from the ISS, we actually have forces ready in case the launch itself or the recovery coming back are non-nominal and it goes off course and something goes wrong. And we have forces ready to support, and we're doing that. That's explicit, and we're supporting NASA today. We'll continue to do that with Orion and Artemis as that moves forward. And it's not just within the terrestrial spheres. If something on orbit were to perhaps go wrong, or NASA had questions about the safety of a spacecraft, you know, we would bring every capability that DoD had to bear to understand what's going on and provide information to NASA. So we're doing that today. And we've been doing that for a long time. When shuttle was still flying, you know, routinely NASA would kind of ask us, hey, you know, can you take a look at the shuttle? We'd find ways to do that. The second piece is one that we need to understand as we go forward, right? It's an open-ended question. Let's just say, for example, that we have commercial space tourists going into space into commercial habitats. Let's just say they're in medium Earth orbit. Who's responsible for their safety and their rescue if something goes wrong? We haven't really thought that through as a government. And so it's just still an open-ended question. Clearly, U.S. Space Command, Space Force are not resourced for that sort of thing. Will that be something that we would want to do? Would it be just a best effort of available capabilities if something were to go wrong? We kind of need to look at that. That's almost more in the sphere of a department other than the Department of Defense to understand how to regulate that kind of activity.
In thinking that through, who do you think it should fall to in terms of doing the initial planning or CONOPS or thinking about this?
Yeah, that's probably an interagency, again, another department that would be responsible for any regulation of commercial tourism. And I think that's still something that our nation's working through.
So speaking about interagency or transcendent missions, I noticed also in General Dickinson's testimony that he said that U.S. Space Command's space domain awareness capabilities help support NASA's planetary defense mission. And you recently participated in a joint or in an interagency tabletop with NASA and the U.S. Space Force looking at the possibility of, and when we say planetary defense, we're talking about an asteroid that might strike Earth. But tell us a little bit about that tabletop and what were your takeaways?
FEMA was also involved in that tabletop exercise, and NASA was the lead, and we participated in U.S. Space Command. And the scenario was what I call the Goldilocks asteroid was approaching Earth, right? It wasn't so small that it would simply be a bolide that exploded above the surface of the Earth, maybe crack some windows or such. And it wasn't so large, it was, you know, the size of a small moon, and there was nothing we were going to do to deflect it, and it was just a waiting fate. It was actually in the middle, right? It could be something that we could deflect, which means to kind of adjust its course far out so it won't intersect with the Earth, or disrupt as it gets closer and maybe break it apart, and so it's less of a threat. And then, you know, as the scenario played out, it had to, right? Because we had FEMA involved and such. Like I said, we failed. We failed on those first two missions because it actually, in the scenario on the tabletop, it hit the Earth, and we had to go through consequence management with FEMA being in the lead for that, and as well as Northern Command, since it in our exercise, it struck in North Carolina, so it was within NORTHCOM's area of responsibility, that geographic area. My takeaway from U.S. Space Command's perspective, though, were a few, and some of the questions I raised were, you know, if we ever were to try to deflect or disrupt an asteroid on collision with the Earth, that would be a huge undertaking. Lindley Johnson, who's a good friend I've known for many years, who runs the Planetary Defense Coordination Office at NASA, he'd be the first to tell you, if he were sitting here with me, that he doesn't have the staff to run that kind of broad, you know, interagency effort. And so one of the things we talked about is how would that be set up? We haven't really thought that through as a government, right? We haven't gotten to that next step, how we would do that. Fairly convinced Department of Defense will be some part of that. Very often the Department of Defense gets called upon to be a central part of any large scale, complex undertaking that by the government. And so what role would we play? Another thing I think is important is that as we get more and more capable as a command and as a space force in understanding the space domain and our sensors get better, they have secondary benefit along these lines where we can actually be of help to NASA and the Planetary Defense Coordination Office. And we're actually doing that today, Pete. Our space surveillance telescope that we have in Australia is capable of actually detecting near-Earth objects, as well as doing space domain awareness closer to the planet. And so we're assisting NASA where we can with that.
And I understand there's some other pretty exciting news. U.S. Space Command for the first time released the light curves of a bunch of these. But first of all, I should go back and say for some of my listeners, what is a bolide? And then what is this exciting thing? You know, why was it a big deal to release light curves? What is a light curve? And what is this potential interstellar object?
All right, we're mixing some really fun stuff in there. So we actually, from the Department of Defense, have been able to collect bolide data for a long, and anyway, for your audience, right? So a bolide is going to be a meteor that tends to be big enough that it gets into the atmosphere and then heats up so quickly, it doesn't just burn out, actually explodes. And these are we've seen some of these recently. Some may remember, I think about a decade ago, in Chelyabinsk in Russia, there was a fairly large bolide that broke an awful lot of windows and sent a lot of people to the hospital. It was a big explosion. Why are we good at detecting these? Well, because we're also responsible for detecting other kinds of large explosive events against the backdrop of the Earth looking at from space. And so we're actually good at that. What we haven't been very good at is sharing that data as readily and as quickly and as completely as we probably could. So we've taken some steps recently in releasing the data that you talked about to NASA and the broader astronomical community. And I think we'll continue to do that. It's just one of many actors in the space domain. And by the way, the sensors we're collecting this data with were paid for by the American taxpayer, right? So we should be sharing this where we can, and we're finding better ways to do it. The interstellar object you mentioned was a special case of a meteor in this case that was observed by some astronomers, but we also observed it. And we were able to see it enough that we collect enough data on it that we could detect a vector, right? Where it was coming from and the velocity at which it was traveling. Those answers that we pushed back to this astronomical community led us to believe it was very likely an interstellar object because of the speed and direction that it was traveling when it came through our atmosphere. Those are just beginnings, I think, of more data sharing that we'll be doing and a more of a convergence of understanding the space domain that Space Command and Space Force will be part of.
You know, I want to contextualize it a little bit about why that may be important. So probably about the time that you and General Warden published your book, I think he was testifying on the Hill that a bolide, if somebody didn't have the kind of space domain awareness that the United States has through U.S. Space Command, they could mistake it for a nuclear first strike, or perhaps even today, a hypersonic first strike. And if I remember right, in Chelyabinsk, at least one Russian politician even accused the United States of testing a hypersonic weapon because they didn't have that ability to disambiguate. And I think Chairman Cooper was quite concerned about a bolide being able to create instability between nuclear armed nations. I understand you guys are looking specifically to be able to get out messages quickly.
So Pete, you're exactly right. I should have said that when I talked about the other utility we bring is it's the other flip side, right? It's also being able to characterize what it's not. One could imagine today if a large bolide event were to happen over eastern Ukraine, it would be a lot more than whatever you said, one person suspecting that it was something other than a bolide. It would be most of the world probably for a while. And so part of the moving forward is to be able to rapidly characterize, and which we do that fairly well, but also get the word out of what the event was and make sure it's characterized appropriately.
You know, when you had talked at Space Symposium and you used the term a little earlier on, you talked about implied missions. So just for those of my audience who may not have been through a joint planning course, what does it mean to have an implied mission?
You know, here's the wrong way to do military missions is for very senior levels of command, and in this case, I'm talking about at the Pentagon, to write down every single conceivable task that you would want a combat command or a subordinate commander to do and issue those and then say, don't do anything but these. That's actually been tried before. It doesn't work very well. The tried and true method of doctrine is mostly about intent. You give a broad mission set. Here's what you're responsible for. Here's some specific things I need you to make sure you do, but you're responsible for more than just that. And if you have any questions, come back to me. I mean, that tends to be a little bit better way of doing what we call mission command, kind of delegate a lot of decision-making down. So with that comes a doctrine of implied tasks. If you're responsible for an area, you're given an assignment for an area of responsibility, what does that now mean? What do you think some of those tasks that may have been not been specifically given to you, but what are the things you need to do to make sure that you are protecting and defending and carrying out your missions with an area of responsibility? So that's just sort of how that's what that means. And making sure that you are prepared to execute as a commander, responsible with given those responsibilities, making sure that you have planned and have the capabilities for those implied tasks that you've done analysis on to make sure you're ready. Because the time to find out you're not ready is not when you're in the middle of it and it's too late and you got an adversary looking at you in the face. That is an art of command. And that is something we're looking at U.S. Space Command. What are we responsible for now that we have this area of responsibility that isn't explicitly given to us and we need to think about?
On that note, you know, I noticed that in the testimony, they're setting the conditions to deter by countering competitive influence, you know, strengthening relationships, and then building and maintaining competitive advantage. And I wanted to ask a little bit about where the thinking in U.S. Space Command is in terms of building and maintaining that long-term competitive advantage. And I realize that U.S. Space Command doesn't have most of the budget, and I may, in a subsequent question, ask a little more about that. But in terms of like pressing or articulating the requirements, is there anything specifically on power and propulsion or in-space mobility where U.S. Space Command is saying, hey, I need this kind of a capability that we don't have today?
So let me first back up and say the first thing that came to my mind when I talked about competitive advantage wasn't actually a material solution, but I'll get to that. I'd be happy to talk about it in a second. It was one of the most valuable things I think that the command can do, and General Dickinson is pursuing this very aggressively, is strengthening our relationships with other organizations. And those could be allies. You know, we have a lot of our allies have done much like we have done and are really focusing on the space domain now. You know, in just the last 2 to 3 years, the French have renamed their Air Force to an Air and Space Force. The Germans and the UK and the Australians have stood up their own space commands. All of those countries are looking at developing their space expertise. And there's great interest in NATO and understanding, they've already declared space as an operational domain and understanding how we would develop a NATO-focused doctrine for space operations. So that's one pace of competitive advantage that shouldn't be new to any of us, right? That's how we do that in other spheres and across our national security enterprise and beyond diplomatic enterprise is we have allies and they contribute to a better security environment. We tend to think about that as being in the terrestrial spheres, but that security environment, I believe, could extend to space. That's part of competitive advantage. I'll quickly hit other organizations. Commercial, we already talked about. We want to leverage them as best as we can, and we want to encourage their investment so that we maintain a competitive advantage as a nation economically and technologically in the space domain. And then interagency. I've talked already a little bit about NASA. I haven't said much about the intelligence. You know, so much of what we depend on in understanding what's going on in the space domain and what potential adversaries could be doing has to involve a fusion of all of our intelligence capabilities in an operational sense, and we're working that hard too. That is a competitive advantage as well. For specific technologies, I could just leave it an open-ended statement. We're interested in the development of any technology that's going to contribute to current or future mission sets. For example, if there proves to be utility in nuclear thermal propulsion or nuclear thermoelectric propulsion that gives us new ways to maneuver in the gravity well or beyond it, that afford us an advantage, a tactical advantage in space, then we want to leverage those capabilities. I'm leaving that open-ended. We could probably tick down any number of capabilities, but I'm always interested. By the way, I get a regular readout from General Pringle at AFRL on the projects that she's working on that she sends out to the space community. And I read that. You bet I do. I want to see what they're working on and what I'm interested in. And I've even endorsed a couple memos over the last year or so back to AFRL saying we are interested in these kinds of capabilities. And so I hope that answers your question, Pete, but we
absolutely
want to leverage competitive advantage in every sense, from the diplomatic on one end to the technological on the other and everything.
It is my understanding that U.S. Space Command is doing a lot in terms of engagement and thought leadership with commercial and international partners, that you've got liaisons and folks embedded with you, but you implied that there would be future mission sets. What future missions do you anticipate or make come up?
Let's say, for example, I want to be able to patrol Lagrange Point 1. I just want to know what's out there, right? And again, for your listeners, this is an interesting gravitational stability point between the Earth and the Moon, a little bit closer to the Moon, and part of that Earth-Moon system that we talked about earlier. Let's say I just want to understand what's going on out there. There's already a few platforms out at that point right now. They tend to be, they're scientific. But what's the right design of a spacecraft for long-term ability to patrol that point? And it's not gravitationally stable out there, so I probably get to maneuver long-term. Would some new technological solution allow me to do that better than what I'm doing today? That would just be one example that I just coming up with right now. I wouldn't want our imagination to be constrained in any way along those lines. Here's another one that just kind of give you a different dimension that we may not be thinking of, because we're thinking kind of hard technologies here. To what extent will machine learning and even artificial intelligence enable the better operation of platforms operating far from Earth, where we actually have humans commanding and controlling them, to tighten down decision cycles, make them more autonomous and more capable of assessing what's going on and maybe even making decisions on their own? And that opens up an entire another category of discussion. But its idea is it may not be a hard technology solution. It may be a software solution that will be help us do our missions better.
Well, I failed to start with why, but I want to sort of end with why, right? I mean, U.S. Space Command is in service to a larger spacefaring vision for the United States, and everybody has a little bit of their own. So I wanted to ask you, you know, if we do things right, all of our separate parts across the interagency and U.S. Space Command, paint me a vision of America's future in space. Where are we going? What's the good story that this is enabling?
Thanks, Pete. This is maybe where I'll transition a little bit from the military figure that you're seeing to the futurist, because I do consider myself a futurist. It's inevitable that we're going to be going beyond this planet, right? And the only scenarios I envision where we don't do that are not very good ones. I hope that those don't play out. And what will that be driven by? It'll be driven by our natural curiosity, and it'll be driven by what so many other ventures in the past beyond normal frontiers have been, and that is a search for something newer, and a search for ways to better the lives of the people back where they were. Sometimes that's economic, sometimes that's technological, sometimes that's just better understanding of the world and or universe we live in. So I do think we're going to be doing all those things. I think before this century is out, there will be myriad commercial interests around the solar system. I think we will have landed and started a permanent colony on Mars. And I think we'll be thinking about what are the next steps beyond that. And I think there'll be a huge interest in that. If you buy that solution where I think we're headed in space, now I can come back again and say, will we do all those things? Will there be no need for any kind of security structure around that? Will it all be done peacefully? I like to say, and I think you've heard me say, but I'll say once more for your audience that I haven't heard, you know, when I'm done with the Space Force thing here and I'm thinking what else to do, if Elon Musk gives me a call and offers me a ride to go to Mars, I might take that. I might go. But I'm going to volunteer for the one job that no one else has volunteered for yet. Still haven't seen it out there. And that is sheriff. Now, if you agree with me on why there would be a sheriff on Mars, we don't have much more to say, Pete. But if someone of your listeners says there won't be a need for a sheriff on Mars, then we need to talk. Because I'm optimistic about the future and where we're going, but we're going to take a lot of our own humanity with us along the way. And those include the things that maybe we are not the most proud of what we do. And hence the need. There will always be a need as we do these things in the space domain for security, for strength to protect and defend those interests as they go forward against those that may wish to oppose them.
So if there's a young person out there thinking about a future in the U.S. military or the U.S. Space Force, what would you say to them?
Well, first I would say, hey, welcome to the adventure. If you are interested in this and this sounds like something that you want to spend your life doing, I think there's huge reward in it. And I would encourage them to just not aim too low.
Well, General Shaw, thank you very much for your generous time today. And I'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Pete. It was a great conversation. Look forward to maybe doing this again sometime soon.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Space Strategy Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe wherever you are listening. For questions and comments, please reach out at spacepod@afpc.org. Thank you for listening.